Hello and welcome to IVF BFF with me, Sian.
And me, Catherine.
A podcast detailing IVF in real time and shining a light on the experience of infertility.
Join us as we lift the lid and demystify all things fertility, sharing our stories, the highs and the lows, and everything in between.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, everybody. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Yeah, all good, all good. We thought we'd have a little catch up, didn't we?
Yeah. It would be good to, as I know that, well, firstly, we have got the wonderful Emma who we're going to be talking to in this episode.
Yes.
But
I think we can lift the curtain and say we have already recorded it.
Yeah, we have. Ooh,
but it's a really good chat.
Really good chat. So please listen. I think it's really educational and informative and just great. Even if you're wanting to learn about the process.
Yeah, and just quite reassuring, you know, there's so much mystery around IVF, fertility stuff, and she kind of really busts all those myths and just gives you the information. It's really informative. So
also we Sian, need to talk about you.
I was going to talk about you actually. Oh. And your trip to Paris.
Oh yeah, just came back.
Sian's been on her holidays.
Yeah, been to Paris.
To Paris with Andrew.
Yeah, we had a lovely time. Andrew proposed to me in Paris 3 years ago. So it was lovely. We retraced our steps and we just walked a lot, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Very much needed, right? After the start to the year, you know? It's fun for you guys.
Definitely. And we've just eaten our weight's worth in butter.
Lovely.
I just feel like everything is buttery.
What else? French onion soup.
Oh, I had it twice.
Love French onion soup.
Oh my god, my favourite. Beautiful. Yeah, really good.
Yeah, and so, you got nice weather as well, didn't you? You got sunshine.
Good weather, went to an art gallery, walked around. We just walked, a lot of walking.
That's nice, yeah. Me and Carl went to Paris a few years ago. We went 8 years ago when we got engaged 8 years ago. Just Aww. After that, we went to Paris. And then actually, because we met on a dating app, we met on Happn. Happn was really new back then. I don't know if it exists now. It's a long time ago. Mm. And we tweeted them to be like, we've just got engaged, and they sent us to Paris. So we went back.
Oh my God.
They were
God.
Like, all you have to do is record a promo video with us when you're there saying that you recommend the app. And we were like, yeah. And they paid for our travel and accommodation for 2 nights. So, but that time, I remember it really raining in Paris, and we sat there by that. There's that little pond with all the chairs around it.
Oh, the Tuileries Gardens.
Yes.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah, we sat there with umbrellas, which is kind of cute. But yeah.
Oh, that's so nice. Gosh, people should do that more often. Just go and.
I think that was when online dating was a bit of a.
Bit new.
Still quite new and a bit taboo, still maybe. So that, I don't know, I feel like it's too commonplace now.
Yeah. People are probably like, well, yeah. Whatever.
Yeah, so did everyone else.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But tell us about everything that's happening.
IVF
with you.
News.
IVF news. It's your birthday tomorrow.
It's my birthday tomorrow. Yeah, during the recording, we had to stop a couple of times because the door went. So if you hear my dog barking, I'm so sorry. But we had to stop because the door went. And I was like, oh, all these deliveries. And it turns out that they're my birthday presents, I think. So, and maybe just a couple of presents I bought myself.
Keep the doorbell ringing, I say.
Yeah. So I'm turning 34 tomorrow on Saturday. So that'll be fun. Basically, yeah, we've got loads of nice things planned because we thought we would be in a 2 week wait by now. But guys, sad news, we are not in a 2 week wait. I know I last spoke on here about our transfer and we were all set to go for kind of now. I thought it would be between the 9th and the 12th, depending on ovulation, that sort of thing. And we were doing a natural cycle. So no meds, following my natural menstrual cycle. and going in for the scans and stuff. And natural cycles can be more tricky to guess and to, you know, predict what's going to happen. And bodies are weird, right? So, yeah, I thought it was a done deal. I was like, yeah, great, going to have a transfer. And that'll be our second go. And then I went in and I was having these scans. And I think last week I said that my follicle was quite small. And they were like, it's just not really growing as it should have been. I didn't know why that was a problem, but it's just an indication that my hormones might not be quite right. So then on the Wednesday, went for another scan and it was like, 14 millimetres. Oh, I said that last time, on the Thursday. But they were like, come back in on Friday, we'll see what it's done. Friday, she's looking around in there and she's like, what side was the main follicle on? And I was like, oh, it's the right side. And she's like, yeah, it's not there anymore. It's gone. I was like, where's it gone? But that's an indication that I probably ovulated from it. She couldn't see the shell, which forms what's called the corpus luteum, which takes place after, that's what the follicle becomes. And that's what will produce progesterone for you, which is needed in case you get pregnant. She couldn't see that, but she said that does take, you know, a day or so to be visible. So I think that I ovulated on Friday morning because Thursday, I didn't have a scan Thursday, but Thursday morning, my temperature was low, indicating it hadn't, you know, you get a temperature spike after ovulation. I think it had just happened, or maybe like Thursday night or whatever. So she was like, oh, we didn't get to see the follicle before it ovulated, and we don't know what size it was, but it's very unlikely that it got to the right size. But she was like, it might still be fine. I'm just going to get you to chat to a doctor. So Dr. Brooker called me back in. And at this point, I was still quite chipper. I was like, yeah, it'll be fine. You know, nurse says it's probably fine. And then Dr. Brooker called me in and sits me down back again. Every time I sit down in front of him, he's like, I knew where it was going really quickly. No. You know how you can tell from like the tone of voice? He's like, right.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It's the like.
It's like, okay. He's like,
yeah. He's like, so, and he talks through everything. He's like, so this has happened. This, he's just like, it's just a bit odd. And it's just maybe not, you know, indicates that maybe your hormones in your luteal phase might not do what we need them to do. I said, well, can we do a blood test? Any kind of anything to do some blood tests. And he was like, well, we can do a blood test in your luteal phase to check your progesterone. But he's like, by then it's too late to do a transfer. You know, we would have had to have made the call about transfer before then. And he was like, you could go ahead if you really wanted to, and we could see. He's like, it's definitely not going to happen. But he's like, and I said at that point, I cut in a bit and I was like, I would rather lose a month than lose an embryo. And he said, I'm glad we're on the same page there. And he's like, my advice would be to cancel this transfer. So you know what, and for all of my chat of like, no, I'm going to fight really hard for a transfer and I really want one and I just want another embryo back in, I did say last week that it makes sense to press pause if it's going to reduce my chances. But in that moment, I really surprised myself because I was like, no, don't do it. Just don't. Okay, I'd rather wait a little bit longer. It's just kicking the can down the road, you know, a little bit longer. And why add more risk to an already very risky game?
And you know? Also, I think it's really good that Dr. Brooker did it that way rather than said, we're going to cancel your transfer. It was like, let's have a chat about it together. Like, this is what we know. This is what we don't know.
It's like when a teacher or a parent makes you think it's your idea, you know? Let's do that. But yeah, I did kind of came to that agreement quite quickly. And it was a little bit disappointing. It's just a bit because you gear yourself up and, you know, it's just more waiting. And we've already waited a long time, all in all. But yeah, we've lost a month. We've not lost an embryo and they're so precious. And so the plan now is to, I did go home and I ate two cream eggs straight away.
The irony.
I know, eggs. Like, someone replied to our Instagram because I put a picture of them being like, you know, drowning my sorrows, and they were like, dark humour alert, that this pack of 5 cream eggs is 3 more than we got on our egg collection, sort of thing. And I was like, you know those reels at the moment? People are doing reels showing their egg collection with flowers.
Oh, I know. I'm not really down for it, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know why. It just makes me feel a bit like, do what you got to do, but it prettifies IVF quite a lot. I'm like, oh, pretty flowers. It's right for some people, cool. But I was like, we should do one with eggs, with chocolate eggs.
Oh my
eggs.
Gosh, you should so do that.
Yeah. Well, if I do another egg collection, I might do. Yeah. Hopefully I won't have to. But and then I had 2 large glasses of wine that evening. Gave myself a night off from IVF. But I've been really good at just staying quite focused and keeping going. And the plan now is to do a medicated round. So we're doing a medicated transfer hopefully in May, hopefully kind of maybe the second week of May. I'm obviously quite nervous that the prep won't go well for the medicated. And I asked the nurse, I mean, they're so great at our clinic, we are lucky, because I asked them a lot of questions about, well, how do, because I'm not being down regulated, but the idea this time is they don't want to see any follicles growing. Everything should be sleepy, but they're not giving me medication to shut anything off, which is called down regulation, which they do sometimes for patients doing a medicated round, but they're not doing that for me. And I was like, well, why not? Well, how can you guarantee that I'm not going to ovulate, etc.? Because if I do grow a follicle this time, game over. We don't want that. Another of the nurses phoned me back, and it was so amazing. She just like told me all the info, which is really interesting, actually. She's like, well, she said, we're giving you a lot of estrogen at the beginning of your cycle. Normally, your body would produce estrogen after you've grown a main follicle. So in hiking up the estrogen at the start of your cycle, it should trick your brain into thinking that there's already a follicle there. So your brain will go, oh, estrogen's high, there must be a follicle, and it won't grow one. How clever is that?
Very, very clever.
So fingers crossed, they say that medicated rounds have a lower chance of being cancelled. You never know in this game. You literally never know. But that's what we're doing next.
It makes sense how you're seeing it. But, I mean, nevertheless, Jesus Christ, it's like, nothing's predictable.
Nothing's straightforward, is it?
No. And also, you know, I know you've booked all of these things to do in the 2-week wait, and it's great that you can now just enjoy them without that doom or dread lingering over. But there also, you know, it's kind of like, you were like geared up for it mentally, weren't you?
Yeah, and it's just a reminder that at any point, like, the goalposts can move. And it's a bit disappointing in the sense that IVF is just so unpredictable anyway. You think you know where you stand, and then you don't, and nothing is a guarantee. But yeah, we are doing some nice things because it's my birthday, and we're going away for a few days because it's Easter holidays as well. And I'll just have to book more nice things for the next 2-week wait, won't I? Actually, I got to say, like, I feel, okay, it's a good day, good days and bad days, but I feel the best physically and mentally that I felt in a long, long time at the moment. Last night, I went with Carl and one of our friends, Paul, who does listen. Shout out to Paul. And we went to see Sugar Babes in London at the O2. Blimmin' love the Sugar Babes.
They're great.
So good. It was just fun. Like, that's the first time really since, well, this year, I think, that I've properly had fun. How sad is that? But, I mean, great that, like, I feel like the colour's coming back a little bit. And Carl got up very early this morning to go do PT clients, but he texted me saying, it's so nice to see you sparkly again. Oh, I'm going to get a bit upset about that. Like, it's so sweet. I mean, like, hey, guys, like, I'm feeling great, but that makes me a bit emotional. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, he's like, you're sparkly again, which is so nice. And just like, that feels really nice. for someone, again, it just makes me emotional all the time when Carl notices it in me. Like when he noticed that, like, I didn't want to do anything and that I was low, like it takes for maybe the person that knows you the best to like pick up on that stuff.
Oh,
I really didn't think I'd cry on this ep. Oh, bloody hell.
Cathartic. But
it's good, and it's yeah. a relief. Like I feel like myself again. And so again, that has a lot to do with 2 months of not being on drugs. I mean, like it's all gonna get ruined again once we start the drugs, probably.
Well, estrogen is like the stuff that we feel good on, though. So I'm kind of thinking.
I think it can make you emotional. Oh God, buckle up, sluts. Here we go. Sorry, that's not just me being misogynistic. We said buckle up, sluts a long time ago.
Yeah,
we did.
Yeah. No, that's a little catchphrase. Yeah.
It's one of our little catchphrases. Yeah. We are staunch feminists, both of us, but buckle up, sluts. Carl did say, he was like, you're back. And he was like, just in time to do it all over again. But honestly, I feel the best that I felt in like this year. And so there's got to be something to be said for... it's so hard because you don't want to wait, and we didn't want to wait, but... like I said to Dr. Brooker, I said, like, well, you did say to wait a cycle anyway. Hate to say it, you're probably right. Like, here we are, we've got the wait. That's what he said to do originally anyway. So, yeah, he did say that he wasn't sure why my cycle was a bit funky, but it might be that it's still quite close to the IVF meds and they're doing something a bit weird. So, but the next cycle, medicated, they can control everything and they give me synthetic hormones. So I'm on from when my period arrives, I think it's next week. I think it's the 17th. Obviously, it can play little tricks on you.
Yeah.
But if all the tracking is what I think, next week, from day 2 of my cycle, I take 4 estrogen tablets a day, spaced out through the day. I'm gonna have to set reminders on my phone because I feel like an injection is very physical, whereas I forget if I've taken my supplements or not. And then progesterone pessaries after the transfer, so that's what we did, and hopefully that should give us a transfer of around the start to the middle of May. So fingers crossed, guys, that
Come
it all
on,
progresses
guys.
As it should.
Yeah. Bloody fingers crossed. And I have to say, I know that it isn't, you know, necessarily on, I know you feel better, but you do look like, I know you've had your hair done and that, but...
I have had my hairs did, guys. I've had my roots done.
But I don't
but
know,
do you notice it?
Yeah, there's a brightness. There is a brightness. Oh. Yeah. There's like a lightness. Yeah, you're kind of glowing and
Oh, thanks, babe. Yeah. getting my sparkle back.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's me. That's me, guys. I'll keep you posted.
Yeah. And send Catherine some love on... Oh, no. When this comes out, it would have been your birthday.
Oh, yeah. retrospective love for my birthday.
It's
Thursday today. It's Friday today. We'll pop this out on Monday morning. Guys, enjoy the chat with Emma. And she is doing amazing things with Fertility Action Network, which is the new movement launched. Campaign, that's it. For greater equality in NHS IVF and, you know, fertility treatment. So, enjoy listening to her. She's a game changer, I think.
We'd love to hear your feedback on it as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, let's crack on then. Here's the interview.
Here we are. Hello, everyone. We've got Emma here, Emma Whitney.
We are so lucky to be joined by Emma Whitney, who is... What's your job title again, Emma? Lead embryologist? Ooh.
No, so I've got one of those job titles that you can't stick on a name badge. I am the director of embryology and genetics at the Evewell Clinic, aka Emma the embryologist.
Emma the embryologist. That would be better on a name badge.
To be honest, yeah, it's smaller. So
And you have the best name to be an embryologist because you are Emma.
I know.
It's like you planned it.
I never realised. And I never realised this until we started making the Instagram page, or I started making it with someone that actually does marketing and branding, because quite frankly, I was just going to stick my face on something and go, anyone want some help? And she's like, no, you've actually got the most perfect name to like alliterate. And I was like, oh yeah. Have we thought about that? But yeah. It's
very satisfying.
It is, yeah. And I've definitely gone through like every single post on your Instagram page. Thank you for helping so many people out there.
No worries. It makes my blood boil when it's just to help unpick it, really. And I hate that we even have to do this, but someone called it leveling the playing field the other day. And I thought that was a really, really good description of what we're actually trying to do, which is level it out and make it that people can call out good and bad behavior equally and know when it's happening.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So we thought we'd start with sort of a bit of chat about you and about your job, etc. And then we do have a lot. We put a question box on Instagram and we got a lot of amazing questions. And we've kind of amalgamated, because we've got so many on the same sort of topics. We kind of amalgamated them into some topics, but we'll ask some questions in a bit.
I was going to ask, for those who are listening and haven't got a clue, firstly, what is an embryologist? Sorry,
an embryologist is no, it's not at all. Actually, I think it's a really good starting point, because I always forget to. I just skip that. Surely everyone knows what it is. So an embryologist is essentially, to put it in its most basic form, is we are the people responsible for everything that involves gametes. We'll use that word a lot, which is eggs and sperm, and embryos if they are not inside your body. Literally from the minute the egg collection or the sperm is ejaculated or the eggs are collected and the embryos, anything that happens from that point to when they go back into embryo transfer or freezing or all of that into a tank, the embryologists do it. The doctors have no visuals and do not, even in my lab, they're not allowed in the lab. Their passes don't let them in. So I think the misconception for me was just how important your embryology team are. Because you can have the best doctors and nurses and you can have the best protocols, but ultimately the magic sits with us to a certain
extent. It is IVF, isn't it? That's you can't have IVF without embryology. You are making people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
And I think, we try desperately. But yeah, so it's about opening the door, because I think actually it must be, you guys know more than me, but it must be incredibly overwhelming to hand over something so precious to someone you've never even spoken to.
I tend to treat the embryologists a bit like, with so much reverence. Don't know about you, Sean,
like,
when you
like
were
God.
Going through. I'm like, oh, guys.
That's my new name. That's what I
put that on a name badge. I remember when
that's
they
really good. It's really short.
Yeah, just God, you know, God of embryos. when they brought in our embryo for our first transfer, I mean, I think I've said on here before, I found my first transfer really magical. I think Carl did too. I hope it's the same the second. It won't be quite the same, but you know. But when the embryologist was like, right, and they were like, now bring in the embryo, and she came in carrying it, I was like, oh, like it's just such. There is so much magic in there, isn't there?
And the way they call as well, you know, when you're in the wait and they call on the morning and you answer the phone and you're like...
Those phone calls to tell you how they're doing. So Emma does all of that, don't you?
Yeah, and actually I think you've hit home on something that people probably need to be aware of. Those phone calls, as much as you're waiting to receive them, they're actually really hard to do as well. Some days they're amazing because all you get to do is deliver good news and you're like, this is just brilliant. But other days they're really hard because nobody wants to give bad news, and we actually have training in it most of the time to make sure that we can deliver it in a way. And actually, if I've got like 5 bad news calls to do, we're only human. It's hard. It really affects us.
For anyone who doesn't know, these calls that we're talking about are the phone calls that embryologists make to IVF patients after their egg collection. And so we get updated every couple of days about the fertilization rates and how many we've got and how many are still going. So for anyone that doesn't know, that's what we're talking about.
Just to touch on that, Emma, when you're talking about, you know, you're only human, it's obviously a very intense job. How do you cope with that day to day? Because you are a human. How do you deal with that?
Some days it really affects you. I think probably over, I mean, I've been doing this for 23 years and it doesn't get any less stressful to do the calls. And I think the minute it became a mute point would be the minute for me that I knew I had to leave the job, because I think once you've lost that ability to connect with your patients, I'm not sure that that is the right job to be in, if that makes sense. We definitely do have to remove a level of emotion from what we're doing, because otherwise we couldn't do this day in, day out. It's these hours, these 8 hour, 10 hour days, they're intense. They are, you know, you're holding people's hopes and dreams all day long in your hands. So, but there has to be an element that we, it's a really, really fine balance between knowing exactly what you're doing and how precious it is, but not allowing it to consume you, because otherwise we just couldn't do it, right? You wouldn't be able to do an ICSI if you were just panicking all the time about, you just have to make it part of the day. So I actually think it's an incredibly challenging skill set, and it's actually the reason a lot of embryologists leave the job, because it is hard. It's really hard to have that level of anxiety years after years after years. So we have music on. When Taylor was in town, we had a lot of Taylor Swift on in the lab.
I love that. So some that went a lot of weeks. People's embryos would have been made to Taylor Swift.
Amazing.
We have a running joke. It's whoever's doing the ICSIs or the biopsies that day in our lab gets to pick the music that comes on the speaker. And there's some eclectic stuff going on in there. It's amazing. But yeah, so there's probably three or four of us in our lab. If you think about really big labs, there could be up to 10, 15 people in those labs working at any one time. And, like any job, I suppose, we chat, we know what everyone's up to. How was your holiday? I don't know. It's, I think people would be really fascinating to see what we get up to behind the closed doors. Nothing untoward, absolutely. But there is quite a lot of normality is what I'm trying to say.
Another day at the office, for you guys. Speaking of being a human and being, the human side of it, I know that you've got, and I hope you don't mind us touching on it, you've got, quite a difficult story yourself in terms of, your path to parenthood. And we will put a trigger warning here in the show notes, because it involves loss, doesn't it? Would you mind talking us through that?
No, I think it's really important that, again, this makes us more human, right? So I became an embryologist when I was 22, straight off the back of uni. Best job ever. I was really lucky. I stayed in London. I got some really good jobs. And by the time I got married, when I was sort of in my early 30s, I was working at the Lister Fertility Clinic, one of the biggest clinics in London. We were a really fab young team. And then me and Simon, my husband, decided to try for family. We were, because actually when you're in fertility, the way that when you're working fertility, you think everyone's infertile, because that's all you're surrounded with. So I was like, right, I know what I'm going to do. I know how to get pregnant in what, that's what we've been trained in university. That's what my whole degree is about, is human reproductive medicine. We were really lucky. Betsy is my little girl, who is now a teenager. She is 11 now, and a little bit sassy. Came along. she's very funny. She came along really easily, like literally first month, bosh, bang, bing. We were like, well, okay, so maybe I'm not going to be on the receiving end of this journey that I deliver to people. And then when we went to try and have our second child, probably 2 years later, I was 35, and again got pregnant really quickly. But at the 20-week scan, we found out that she had multiple cardiac issues that were incompatible with life. So I actually ended up having a termination for medical reasons at 24 weeks pregnant.
Oh my gosh.
I'm so sorry.
I left work, and it was bizarre, because even though I work in this field and I knew this happens, it's that, oh my God, it's so rare. And I literally left work one afternoon to go for my 20-week scan, and I didn't come back for 8 weeks. I also shouldn't have gone back after 8 weeks, but that's a whole other conversation. And I think that for the next probably year, what happened after that was just horrific, because not only did I go back to work, and there were patients that I'm actually quite tiny. So people knew, patients knew I was pregnant. It's quite hard to hide in scrubs when you're small. And I had to go and live that again. And there's very little understanding of what loss at that time in your pregnancy looks like. There's no real bereavement leave. I mean, it's definitely getting better, but I was straight back in the lab, and one of the first phone calls I did was to a woman that just lost a baby at 30 weeks. I did that whole call.
My God.
And then I threw up in the bin because I was like, I can't be exposed to these calls at the moment. I just wasn't in a stable enough place. And what followed then was a year of three miscarriages for me, two of which required surgery, all while making other people's families.
Dreams come true.
Oh my God, Emma. Yeah.
It's weird looking back on it. I don't really, which just makes me really sad, because I also had by the time this was all going on, I had a 2.5, 3.5, 4-year-old little girl at home to look after as well. And I don't really remember that year because it was incredibly bleak and awful. So lo and behold, anyway, my seventh pregnancy was Fred, who is now seven. And Catherine knows that he is a delight of a Tasmanian
devil. He is a firecracker, isn't he? He's a little whirlwind.
How old is he?
He's seven now, so there's four and a half years between. Yeah, so she's 11, he's seven.
Got it.
And I think I remember what a lot of people will feel if they're listening to your podcast, if they're maybe with secondary infertility, it's that constant, oh, if I get pregnant this month, there'll be this age gap. And it becomes an absolute obsession, a bit like trying to get pregnant in the first place. Mm-hmm. I can only reassure people that my two get on really well, and they're 4.5 years apart, and they're mm-hmm. actually great buddies. But and then I think, if I'm completely honest, it wasn't until he was 2 or 3 years old that I actually started to process what had happened to me. And I was really? Like, oh my God, this is like, that's trauma. Mm. I felt like for a really long time, although I had these two beautiful children, I was just existing, and I hadn't actually processed the trauma or the grief that comes with going through something like that. And then actually that is how Emma the embryologist came about, because I realized that a lot of what I was experiencing and I hadn't processed was traumatic loss and grief. And a lot of it came from not knowing and not having any advice on how to deal with all of that. So I did get some bereavement counseling, and then I started realizing that actually a lot of the way I felt around it was because I didn't understand it. I didn't understand what happened, the why and all of that. And I realized that I will never be a termination for medical reasons expert. I can tell you what it feels like from my perspective, and I can tell you all of that, but I realized that actually this is what infertility must feel like for so many people. And that's when this light bulb dawned on me that actually I held the key to a lot of people's anxieties to help them unpick it. And by sharing my story, it made me more human. It made people feel less alone, because I do remember, her name was Dorothy, the little girl we lost. And I do remember trying to find stories like mine to feel less alone, and there weren't any. So it all sort of came together when Fred was about, I don't know, 4. I joined the EVEWELL. As part of that change, I needed to move. I needed to be somewhere different. I needed to do patient care properly. And so here we are. And that is something that actually has helped me heal. It's helped me... And I really know now that it's helped so many people to understand that if that's what they're experiencing, they're not alone. I think my story was in The Guardian a couple of years ago. And like I said, and the reason we do this now is because I know people are scrabbling around trying to find information that is tangible and not just Googling. People are very aware that Google is not their friend.
Yeah, you will always find what you're looking for on Google. If you're looking for good news, you'll find it. If you're looking for worries, you'll find it, you know. And I feel we feel like this too. I mean, we can't speak from a clinical point of view, of course, because we're obviously we're not that. But we feel too like this is so shrouded in mystery, and so it's so mysterious. And you just want someone to kind of sit down and give you the facts. That's why, Emma, you are so brilliant. I've always said you're so brilliant at this, because you give it to people straight, having been on the receiving end, but with so much love. And it's like, here's the facts, but I love you. Wrapped up in like, you know.
But that's all it can be. This is not a pretty journey. This is bloody hard. Let's not sugarcoat it. Let's be really factual. Let's arm you with the tools you need to help you do what you need to do, advocate for yourself, understand. At the end of the day, if you don't want to understand this, you don't have to read the post, right? You don't have to, you could just put some blinkers on and go through it. And that's fine too. But you shouldn't be Googling for stuff that is being, like, advice given by people that actually do not work.
Or Reddit. My God. Reddit.
Mumsnet.
Terrible.
Mumsnet.
And also, I don't know how you feel about it. I don't know if this is controversial, but I feel like there's a lot of, obviously there's a lot of amazing podcasts and information and stuff like that out there to inform, but I feel like some, and they're not fertility ones, there are more big name podcasts that are there to scaremonger, yes, and are there to sensationalise, and it's there for clickbait. And I don't know, Emma, if you probably do have a certain opinion on it.
I have a lot of opinions on it. I actually just think, I always say this, I don't know, if it sounds sensational, it probably is. And actually,
yeah, that's a good
thought. Is your answer. If it sounds like it's wacky and sensational, move on, because unfortunately there is a desperation yields money, and people will prey on that to get money. And I would just, that's what I find most, that's my biggest distressing bit about this.
And you know what? Yeah. People will send you those links. I got sent one last week of a pretty sensationalized podcast of like, you should do this. This is why you're not getting pregnant. And Carl got the same link sent to him. And he was just like, well, this won't make my sperm. This won't give me any more sperm. So thanks. But do you know our issue? But it's easy because we've got a clear cut reason. Not that anything's clear cut, but people send me these things, and people send other fertility patients these things thinking they're helpful. And that's why we're like, go to Emma, guys. Emma's got the most helpful page and resources. Do you know what I mean? I feel like you're the remedy for that stuff.
And the spirituality stuff, you know, positive thinking, you've got to manifest it. And I'm like, honey, if we could manifest a baby.
I'd have the Von Trapps by now.
Me
do you know
too.
What I mean?
Yeah.
Exactly. And I wouldn't have a job.
That's true.
Yeah. And I get, to be honest, guys, I get it as well. So when I've already put posts out that are like, obviously from, like, I don't just make them up and then decide that I'm going to put it out there. It's got like 20 years of experience backed behind it. And I have patients that are people on Instagram that will say to me, you absolutely don't know what you're talking about. There's a whole Facebook group that know about this and talk about it. And I'm like, Facebook group, signed
Facebook,
paper.
Dr. Facebook.
Yeah, where are you getting your info?
I'm going to go with, okay, you do you. but yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Well,
my God. I was, another question, Emma, is when you're working with the doctors and the nurses, how what does that look like? Because I guess we don't really ever see you. We hear from you. We see you in the transfer or just before. How do you liaise? How does that work?
So I think my clinic's quite interesting. It's quite unique because the embryologists at the Evewell are a huge part of your journey. We actually do quite a lot of the one-on-ones. We do the consultations as well, because actually a lot of your treatment plan sits with what we are. We're potentially unpicking previous time-lapse videos, or we're looking at stuff like that. So we would actually liaise with the doctors a lot more. In a lot of clinics, the way it works generally is the doctors will make treatment plans for patients. And actually the embryology team probably just follow a treatment plan that is, you know, this egg collection is going to be here. So I think it depends on how big the clinic is, right? Because if you're in a really, really big clinic, you'll have an embryologist that will do egg collections all day, because there will be enough for them to do that all day. In my clinic, for example, where we would do four egg collections, I might do egg collections in the morning and then go downstairs and do the ICSIs, and then we would liaise with the doctors. We actually liaise on Teams all day long. About
really?
Patients. So we'll be
really?
Talking. Yeah, we use Teams. So I'm in a Harley Street building, or Hammersmith. They've both got like four floors, so we don't run up and downstairs or use phones. We just Teams like all the doctors. So I think we are quite unique, because the nurses, the doctors and the embryologists have a review meeting every day of every single person that's been in for a scan to make sure that everyone's bloods are covered off, everyone's, like, anything that needs bringing up. So it's like a constant dialect over Teams meetings. And yeah, I don't know, we're really involved. I don't think it is the case everywhere, to be honest. And I think that's sad, because actually we've got a lot to bring to the table. We've got a lot that I might see on your notes where I'll be like, actually no, like, that patient can't have IVF, they definitely need ICSI. And we just pick up things like that. So we work really closely with the doctors, and the doctors actually ask us for treatment plan advice and stuff. And same with the nurses. The nurses are really good at also bringing up things like, this patient's incredibly anxious and therefore she cannot have a 10-minute appointment, she needs a 20-minute appointment. because actually this is just going to take some time. And it's that, for me, that is patient care.
That's care, isn't it? Yeah.
That's care. Wow.
That's what it should be a given, but sadly isn't, you know?
No.
Yeah.
Wow, amazing. Really? So I guess that leads on to your what would be a typical day for you then?
Typical day for me is now quite different because as I sort of have to look after I've got two laboratories worth of staff. So we've got about 14 embryologists across the two sites. I've got two amazing lab managers that sit in both sites and look after the day to day. I go in clinically probably once or twice a week, just if someone's like, if there's annual leave to cover, I'll go in and do whatever's the rotors. We've got rotors. So we've got, the idea is having every task has got a responsibility assigned to it. So nothing is ever missed and everything is obviously covered off because you do have working hours in the day. So yeah, we have rotors. So someone will be on lab one and that will mean egg collections. And then they'll come down from the egg collections and do things like embryo freezing. So it really depends what you're rotated on. What's really, really interesting about what we as a company and myself desperately have been trying to build out is remote working for embryologists, which someone will think is mad.
Working from home,
because the technology that we have now, time lapse and everything, allows embryology to be, I could access all my embryos right now and I'm at home today and I can see all my embryos in the lab because I've got time lapse and I can access the incubators. And it became this thing where I was like, actually, embryologists are, I would say 90% of embryologists are female, which is really interesting. And it became a thing that actually when, you know, when we go through life, things happen, there's train strikes, there's school strikes, they have kids, they have sick kids, all of that. And you are then losing a member of staff from your team that is really integral to your team. And so you end up on a short staff number. And actually by allowing this to be built out to a bit more of working from home, we actually have working from home in our rota, so we're able to keep ourselves really well staffed. So you as a patient, what's really good about it is you as a patient, if you need a call from an embryologist, you don't have to wait till the clinical work's done because someone's rotated on your calls all day. So you've got this element of contact all the time, and it was about making that really important and valuing embryologists as humans. And also, like I said to you earlier, the stress of being in that lab 8 hours a day, five days a week, is the reason people leave this job. So to try and break that up and give someone a bit of time out and they can do calls, and we do grading at home, we can do all the computer work at home, we can do all the emails, you know, the answering of queries and all of that. And actually, I'm really waiting on it, but I've just submitted an abstract to ESHRE to talk about the benefits of remote working for embryology burnout. Watch this space, because I'm really hoping they'll let me talk about it.
Wow, it's really amazing. And you
very
must
unusual,
be
but it's...
Yeah. Why do you think that there's more women, female embryologists?
I mean, the cynic in me says men have got big hands and they're probably not quite as diligent, although I do know some amazing male embryologists. I don't know. I suppose it's a bit like anything, isn't it? Midwifery, nursing.
Yeah. It makes me think...
female-led.
It makes me think, do people come to it through their own personal experience? But then that's quite silly, because obviously I'm not going to wake up tomorrow and be like, I'm going to be an embryologist.
Yeah.
You know, so no, people so. Start on that path before.
I don't know, actually. It's really interesting. I think it's maybe comes from... The route into embryology is like through biomedical science degrees, or I did that and then I did a human reproductive biology master's. But I couldn't tell you. I really don't know but then, like I said, I suppose you could have the same argument for lots of female dominated jobs, just like midwifery, because I think that's about the same percentages as well.
Yeah. Oh, this is interesting. What do you find most surprising about your job? Is there like strange things you go, what?
Yeah. I think after 23 years, you sort of think there isn't going to be anything surprising. And then something will happen and you'll go, ooh. And then you can explore those things. I've got a case at the moment, actually, that is fascinating. And I suppose it's because some of the stuff is so rare. And I'm a big believer in rare is only rare until it happens to you, having been on the receiving end of something that was 1 in 500,000. I think that is still what blows my mind, is that I think I've treated tens of thousands of different situations, couples, single women, same-sex couples, you know, I've done so much different treatment over my years. I thought maybe I'd seen it all. And actually, that's very naive because nobody could have seen it all. And yeah, sometimes something comes along and you go, oh, and it just changes your perception on something. So yeah, I think that's the most surprising thing about our job.
And I'm guessing there's still so much to learn. You know, there's so much.
I think we're learning all the time. Yeah. Yeah, because technology's changing so much. Embryology technology is changing so much. It happens really quickly. Like, even if you're off for a certain length of time, you know, some of the girls go on maternity leave, for example, and coming back, and things do just shift because we're trying to constantly keep up with new developments. And, you know, this is a science that is only really 48 years old.
It's mad, isn't it?
And so we are trying, and it's exponentially growing. And obviously we are in, and I've said it before, we are in a fertility pandemic. Because there is no funding, there is no male fertility research that there needs to be, and all of these things, and it is only going to become bigger. And so what we're trying to do is keep up and make it better as quickly as possible. And it's fascinating how quickly it changes.
Why do you think that is the case? Because obviously we know that the birth rate's declining. I know that people, they always say this. It's because people
women
are having
are leaving
babies.
It later.
Yes, yeah, that's what
women
you always
are leaving
hear.
It too late.
Fault, right?
Yeah, it's all of us.
Yeah. It's almost like we can. They think we can reproduce on our own.
Yeah, like why? But why is this happening? Like, I don't understand it. Is it because our health? Are we not? I don't understand it. Yeah.
So male sperm counts have declined by 50% in 50 years. And we know that that's probably something to do with the lifestyles and the different lifestyles we're leading. With even when we try not to, we're still, you know, if you think about all the toxins and everything we're exposed to that we can't always control, I think there's a lot of that potential. Yes, women are, as the female reproductive partner of this couple, or so, however you come to this journey, women are definitely almost being forced to leave this later in their lives because we are fundamentally not supported, especially not in this country, to have children younger. The childcare costs, the, you know, the time off work, the maternity care is, if you look at places like Scandinavian countries, they've got that sorted. They've got such good maternity policies. And so yeah, I think it's a combination. I think actually education is really lacking in schools. I've been recently going into the senior schools in Teddington and Kingston, where I live, and it's been the most fun telling 16, 17 and 18 year olds what they can do to think about their reproductive choices that they make now that will affect their later.
Amazing.
I bet it's that so is amazing.
It's so brilliant.
I think that brilliant. Is fantastic, because we all say at this point, everyone only told us at school how not to get pregnant.
Yep.
Do not get pregnant. It's like that line from Mean Girls. Do not have sex. You will get pregnant and die. Obviously, he won't die. But like, we were just told, don't get pregnant. Here's how to put a condom on a banana. Like, yep. And no one tells you about your... I didn't know what a luteal phase was in my menstrual cycle until I was 32. How mad is that?
I didn't know any of it.
And also, it's like going into these schools is amazing because these, you know, young females and males are still so unaware of the impact of certain things that they're doing on the cause of their fertility. Vaping is awful.
Big.
It is awful. It's been proven. It is not a good thing. Yet, it's you know, it's down with the kids and it's cool. And when you start to say to them that actually that could be the reason that you end up with reproductive issues, they look at you as though to say, what? Am I? But no one is telling them this. So I do think a lot of education needs to change. I think that we need to, and it's not, I have no intention of going into schools and saying, right, you've all got to be pregnant by 25. Absolutely not. But it's about having reproductive awareness, you know, catching a sexually transmitted disease in your early 20s that goes undiagnosed is a massive reason why you're sat in front of me 10 years later with tubal infertility.
Wow.
And these are things that we can prevent. You know, this is stuff that if we educate on, we can prevent that. Sexual
and reduce the shame over, right?
Yeah.
Stigma. As well, stigma and shame, and people don't want to talk about it. And yeah, I think you're doing amazing work, Emma, in everything. But yeah. God, as if you weren't busy enough already. She's going into schools.
Yeah.
I love it. It's like watching light bulbs come on in their heads. It's amazing.
Bing. Great.
Wow. That is amazing.
This is probably a good moment to kind of segue into some questions that we have from our sort of Instagram lot, if that's okay. The first thing we wanted to touch on was, okay, so day 3 versus day 5 or 6 embryos. Do you put one back? Every question Emma's going to go, Right, okay. Yeah. You're gonna heard it all before. Yeah,
you're gonna be a bit bored, I think, by this.
I don't think it is boring. I think it's fascinating that these questions go round and round with the technology we've got. So yeah. Day three versus day five or day six.
Yeah, when to transfer one back.
I think it really depends on a lot of it's personal choice. You know, it's about, I think we have to stop putting this massive belief on that people don't have choices in this. You absolutely do have choices on this. And I'm a big believer that whatever you need to do to protect your mental health and get through parts of these journeys is absolutely okay. And it's massively important that your mental health is protected. But make no, I make no other comment than in a good lab with a good incubator, embryos do not need anything other than that lab environment if it's a well-functioning lab, which if you think about in the UK, we're so heavily regulated that, you know, the incubators we've got are very compatible to support embryos growing to the blastocyst stage. Saying that, if you've got one embryo, I'm not going to change the outcome of that embryo by keeping it in the lab. I'm not going to make it more likely to work. And if your inherent desire is to have a transfer, then putting it back on day three isn't ultimately the wrong thing to do. But I will try and flip that on its head and say that if, for example, you're in time-lapse incubators, which is the incubators with camera, which I think they are game changers for embryologists in this world. If you do transfer any embryos on day three and then you have a negative test, I am really going to struggle to tell you why, because I'm not going to know whether that embryo failed after day three and therefore didn't grow and therefore wouldn't have been transferred because it didn't make a blastocyst. Or I'm going to be able to watch that development more in under a time-lapse incubator and say that, you know, I can now, and if for whatever reason the cycle doesn't work, I can help you unpick it because I've got the full range of visuals. So I think there's pros and cons to both sides of this. If you have a group of embryos growing, for me, it is an absolute no-brainer to be putting embryos back on day five, because we have our funnel effect of embryos that will and won't grow. And ultimately, the ones that won't grow won't make it to day five. And the ones that do, we can then transfer, or we can keep them till day six or seven and do some freezing, whatever your treatment plan is. But there is so much knowledge to be gained in embryos and what they do and how they develop. I have picked up proper male factor stuff that has been missed just by watching an embryo grow in the lab and it not doing certain things and making certain movements. So I would love to be in a world where we could support our patients enough that the emotion doesn't take over and they don't have this inherent need to do a transfer. But it's about having that support network and understanding that, you know, all of that. So big believer in blastocyst transfers, but I'm also a very big advocate for making sure that you are 100% in a good mental health space for whatever decisions are taken.
And then just on that as well, it was one of our later questions is about the funnel. You just mentioned it there. It might be a good time to touch on. A lot of people, especially if you've been through the process, you will know that the attrition rate and the IVF funnel. Could you talk us through that, please?
Yeah, so the IVF funnel is at every stage in the journey, which is from the eggs coming out to the fertilization, to the eggs being mature. All of those things have a drop off. And actually, it's that drop off that can be quite clinic dependent as well. We talk a lot about success rates and people pick clinics based on success rates. But actually, I want to flip that on its head, because the success has to come before you see those statistics on a website, right? Because if you don't make embryos in the lab, because if the lab's not functioning correctly or your stimulation wasn't good enough for you or whatever reason that there's no embryos at the end, you don't get to end up in those success rates on the website because you don't have any transfers, so you don't actually end up in those numbers. And I think the key take home here is that, you know, eggs collected, you then have to have eggs that are mature, you then have to have eggs that fertilize, and you have to have those embryos then develop into an embryo that is what we call usable. And it's that that causes this reverse pyramid. And it's really, really dependent on so many things that are controlled by doctors and nurses and embryologists. So is your stim really good? Are you being monitored closely? All of these things will give the embryologist better eggs to work with. When we've got better eggs to work with, we can then increase the fertilization rates and then the embryos will grow better. So when we talk about the funnel, it's about understanding that that can be very different cycle to cycle, clinic to clinic. And that is a very, very hard conversation to be even sat having, let alone I can imagine hearing. And that is the honest truth of it.
Well, why don't we talk about embryo grading?
Embryo grading is the next.
The elusive question. Embryo grading. So
we all know not to take stock, and you know, we hear not to hold too much worth, but we do, don't we? We all hear those grades and we go and we cling on to them. So can you talk us through the grading system and stuff?
So yeah, grading up to day three embryos normally will involve just a cell number. So on day two, embryos should be between 2 and 4 cells. On day three, they should be between 6 and 8 cells. What I am going to caveat that now is when people are told that their embryos looked fine until day three and then they didn't grow to blastocyst, you can actually only know that an embryo looked fine on day three if they're under a camera, because actually embryos can make abnormal divisions at the very, very first, that first division where they should go 1 to 2. And actually embryos can go 1 to 3 immediately. And that's actually embryo fatal. They don't develop from then. Unless you've got a camera on those embryos, you cannot know that that has happened. And they, even those that go 1 to 3 can then look like really nice 8 cells on day three visually. But that thing that happened at the beginning is detrimental. So this again is where time lapse is really interesting. So I hear quite a lot of people say, oh, my embryos were fine until day three. And I was like, were they under time lapse? And they're like, no. I said, then you simply can't know that, because you don't actually know what the division was that got them to that point. So, but we would normally just use like 4 cells grade one. For me, grade one is better, which means there's no fragmentation. I think day three grading is incredibly hard because people will fixate on the fragmentation. I can't tell you the amount of embryos I've seen that look absolutely awful on day three and then go on to make beautiful blastocysts. So it's really hard. I think when we talk about blastocyst grading, the number that sits at the front does not determine quality. It determines journey. These embryos are on a journey. They are continuously growing. And I think also the misconception is that journey ends. It doesn't. It carries on as these embryos go into you and they're just going to implant. It's cell division. They are differentiating, which means becoming cells that have a design, and they are becoming bigger and then they will hatch. So an embryo is in its shell most of the time before it's transferred. They normally hatch out of that shell day 6, day 7, and that is to implant into the lining of your womb. That's when they are looking for a blood supply. And to be honest, that's when my babysitting has to stop, because I can't give them that blood supply. So I either have to transfer or freeze at that stage before. The aim is always to get to them before they're hatching. So the number you get, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, is to do with how big the balloon of fluid, which the blastocyst is growing inside its shell. Imagine a balloon filling up with water, how big that's getting. And that is just simply it growing and getting bigger and becoming ready to hatch and having enough force to hatch. The A's, the B's, the C's, the D's we use are all to do with what they visually look like on that given day. So the first letter is the inner cell mass, which is the bit that makes the fetus in the blastocyst. The second letter is the other cells, which are called the TE cells, trophectoderm cells, or what we then go on to form the placenta. This is not a flat object. This is obviously a ball, so it rolls.
I forgot that.
Yeah, how mad is that? Flat, right, but it's not.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But when I look at them, if I'm trying to grade an embryo, although we've got obviously cameras on them and stuff, if I'm really like not sure, I will roll that embryo to get a good visuals on it.
Right.
But A's, B's, C's and D's, you can have, and I think it isn't just about the grade. How did they get there? What did they look like on their journey? Did they make normal divisions? Secondly, when did they get there? A day 5 embryo is more likely to make you pregnant. A 4, okay, let's call it. So A's, B's, A's and B's are good quality. C's are average. D's, for me, are embryos that are starting to degenerate. There is also, to make this clear, embryos can still fail in their growth, even around when they're like mid-range blastocysts. So we might have an early stage blastocyst on day 5 that we would leave until day 6, and it may not make it there. So it is never a given that it will carry on. What we would do is A's, B's, C's and D's and all of that. So say I've got a 4BC, which is an expanded, a 4 is an expanded blastocyst with a B grade inner cell mass and a C grade, so an average trophectoderm, but that is a day 5 embryo. That is still going to give you more babies than a 4AA on day 7, because the length of time these embryos take to get there correlate to pregnancy outcome. There's not a lot between day 5 and day 6 embryos, but my point is, it's not all about the letters the embryo's given. Right. It's about the journey. Mm.
So a day, so you're saying basically a day five is always going to be better than, say, a day three, potentially,
six. I think it depends. If you've got a 4cc on day five, so we've said, look, oh, it's not great, and the development patterns are not great, I would definitely probably look at the AA on day six. But it's about having more than those numbers and letters. It's about,
it's the whole picture, right?
Mm. It's the whole picture. So if someone said to me, I've got a 4AA, what's my chance of the pregnancy? I'm going to go, what day is it? And how old were you when it was collected? So the age of the egg, was it screened? How did it divide? When did it get there? And then what did it look like? Can you see that that's my fifth thing that I'm
my
looking
God.
At? So I'm trying to break that down into, don't fixate on it. There is so much more that we're interested in than just what someone somewhere on a moment in time has given you as a grade. I might disagree with it. I'm a human. Mm. It's graded by a human. Mm. I actually would love to have good, average and poor buckets, because I reckon you could pop embryos into them and we would all
That'd
agree.
That'd be easier.
But you will, but you won't get the same letters out of me as you will one of the juniors. You just won't.
So, oh my gosh. So basically, you know, it that's actually quite reassuring for people out there, you know, in terms
who
of
are fixating
they,
on those letters and numbers. And also, I suppose it's true, isn't it, that a clinic worth their salt will not transfer one that they don't think has a decent chance.
100%. I won't freeze an embryo just for the sake of freezing an embryo. I wouldn't do that to my patients, because I would have the really hard, honest conversations to not put you through an unnecessary 2-week wait. That is not okay. Mm. You know, let's be really honest. After 20 years of doing this, I can gauge embryos that are failing, and I can have really open conversations. It makes me sad that the only tangible bit of information that so many patients are given are that number and two letters. And that is why we grapple with it, and that is why we fixate on it, because we're not told anything else.
So can we ask, you know, when that embryologist calls us, can we ask more questions?
You can, for sure. It depends. Again, have they got the time lapse? I know I say this a lot, but it's so powerful, because watching their journey is so interesting to see whether something unusual and or concerning is going on. So unless they've got that, they may not have that information. They may only have what they can see at the end point. But you can certainly start to ask about, you know, if it's day five or day six or day seven. That should all be in your reports. It should never be that you don't know that.
Mm. And then, I mean, we'll come to this with, because we've got another question about add-ons, but with the time lapse, is it the case that some clinics have it and some don't? I think one of our Instagram friends said to us that they were being charged a lot to use it as an extra, that sort of thing. And that feels so wrong when, I mean, welcome to fertility, but when it could really help someone's chances.
Yeah, it's quite, so they are, the reason it's like that is they are incredibly expensive bits of kit. Mm-hmm. They are, I'm talking six figures, like six figures. They're about $100,000.
Wow.
These incubators. So they're not, you know, to run a lab off them, it is incredibly expensive. So yeah, so yes, not all clinics have them at all. It's and I think I never used to have them, and now I've got them, I couldn't actually work without them for what I know it does for patient care.
If someone's being offered it at an extra cost, it's one of those things worth considering. Sorry, that's a big question, isn't it?
It's a big question, but it's about... So I always say, when you come through as a patient, for me, it's about getting you pregnant. 100%. That is what it's about. But if I can't do that, I really want to be able to tell you why. And a lot of that is in the knowledge of what's happened in that dish. So yeah. I think it's invaluable for, I think we would all love to have one cycle of IVF, create loads of embryos and have our family, okay? And in an ideal world, wouldn't that be lovely? But that's just not the reality for so many people. And it's so hard to help people work out what they do next or differently if you don't have certain aspects of understanding of what's gone before.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
So on embryo and egg quality, we had a lot of questions about, can I improve my embryo and egg quality? What is there anything in our control that we can do to help get the very best eggs and embryos?
So what we can't do is turn back time. Okay, we can't make ourselves younger. And a lot of when we talk about egg quality, I hate the word quality, I must admit, because it makes you think that we can see it, and we can't, by the way, we really can't. Some eggs can look really poor visually and they can do absolutely fine. So we don't really make many comments on them unless they are, unless we're concerned about, you know, being able to utilise them because they look poor. So I think egg quality comes from probably three or four different factors. One is age, which we can't do anything about. One is definitely nutritionally led. I've seen people make really solid changes to their own personal, you know, cutting out smoking and drinking and all of that. Of course, these are toxins. We know that that's going to have an effect. It does take 3 months. But if you're doing it and you have a male partner, he's got to do it as well, because there's no point in you making brilliant eggs and he's still chugging beer and vaping down the pub, because that's that, your eggs aren't going to recover from poor quality sperm. So it's got to be a joint thing. There are two elements going into this to make an embryo. So yeah, age, genetics, you can't change. You can definitely, you know, make sure your ovaries are functioning. Stimulation. How you are stimulated and what protocol you're on has got an effect. Are you being given too high a dose? Are you being left on stims too long? Are you not being scanned regularly enough? All of those things, that is a factor that can be changed and will change the quality of those eggs that are delivered to the lab.
Layered. And would you know about that, or would a doctor, would you be the person to go, hey, doctor, this, no. Okay, no. But we can ask not our consultants that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think if you have a fail, so I, what was it I said once? It's the definition of, is it Albert Einstein? I don't even know who said it, but it's the definition of madness is to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different outcome.
Completely.
And you can't, like, we have to move. I'm not saying everyone's got the answers on the first cycle. Of course they don't. We a lot of us are guessing on how you're going to respond, and we're basing that on your hormones and what your scan looks like and all of that. But there's so many different drugs out there that we can use, and there's lots of tweaks we can make that it's okay to ask those questions, for me.
So. That leads us on to, quite nicely, another big topic we got, which was age, and which was success rates. I mean, we all get told 35 you fall off a cliff. I know that's not true, yeah. But especially 35 and then over 40s, a lot of people were asking about, yeah, about success, about if it's harder. We know it's harder, but how does age play a factor?
So as we get to our mid-30s, we sort of plateau a bit from our mid-20s to our early 30s, where things seem to be quite stable in regards to the ability to make genetically normal eggs. It's all about genetics. You are born with all your eggs, so your eggs are sitting in like a dormant state. And as we get older and those eggs are being released, they are starting to make more genetic errors when they have to become half the chromosome number that they are. So we're all our cells have 46 chromosomes in them. Eggs and sperm have 23, so that when they come together, they make a new 46 chromosome entity. Sperm are being ticked over all the time. Don't men get away with loads of things that we don't? But eggs are sat in our bodies, and as they're trying to half and make themselves 23 and 23, they actually make errors. So they make more errors as we age. So miscarriage rates increase, infertility rates increase. And also at the same time, you are getting less eggs. So your AMH is dropping. So your ovarian reserve is dropping, and the eggs you are producing are poorer in their genetic function. So ultimately you're getting hammered by both sides of the coin, but it is not quick. It is not this massive drop off that happens. It is this between sort of 35 and 38. It's a gradual decline. We see it definitely in the lab that we definitely get less eggs and we're struggling to make the embryos that we're making. But it's not overnight. Your ovaries don't know it's your birthday. It's not like, it's just not overnight. As we get into our 40s, it's actually quite profound, because what's happening is we're getting into our perimenopause years. So I think the last paper I read, it is that when we are battling with how, when you talked earlier about what can we do about our egg quality, and we're like, oh, it takes 3 months to do this, we as clinicians have to sit there and say, are those 3 months going to actually be too long for your reproductive aging? So if you're sat in front of someone that's 41, 42, we have to really weigh up the benefits of sending that person away for 3 months or cracking on, with the fact that we know that every month things start to decline by about 1.5%.
Wow.
Okay. Wow.
After we're 42 for sure.
So that's quite scary.
But that is really scary. But that is, so that is why I like to talk a lot to patients about family building now. you are never going to be as young as your patient is never going to be as young as they are now sat in front of you. So if you have a person that's coming for their first child at 38, 39, the really, really honest and the most helpful conversation you can have, as much as they may not want to hear it, because all they want to do, as you well know, is be pregnant now. Immediately, I want it now. Is actually want to tell yesterday. Them to pause a minute. I want it yesterday, I want it last year. It's to tell them to pause for 5 minutes, because if I can do another egg collection on you now and create more embryos now, if we are able to create more embryos now, I know at the moment most people can't even imagine having more than one child. But originally it probably looked like two or three children in lots of people's idea of what their family looked like. So if you can have those conversations and say, you're 38, I hopefully can make you pregnant now, but you're going to be sat back in front of me when you're 40. And it's going to be a lot harder for me to then make more embryos. So it's bravery. It's actually really brave, because I can't tell you how many times I've had this conversation. I thought someone was going to punch me just from the fact that I'm saying, whoa, 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 let's just stop a minute. And they're like, no, I want to go. I want to keep, like, I want to get on that train and I want to
get a transfer.
But it's about having the really honest conversations that you're never going to be as young as you are right now.
The sad truth of that, that sounds like a really brilliant sort of plan of action. But the sad truth is that if you are governed by the IVF, by the NHS, we don't get to elect to have another egg collection. Or sometimes you just get one. After this next transfer of mine, I know that I can opt for another egg collection, even though I will have two more embryos, which we are so lucky and we would be doing, because I've spoken to you, Emma, and you're like, it's a good idea. So we would be getting that. But so many ICBs state that you have to use up all your embryos before you get another. And we hope it doesn't get to that. But I do think that it should be said, and there's nothing we can do about it, but that is a privilege afforded to those that can go private, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that leads us on really nicely to ICBs, NHS, and what we're trying to do about this. So we're actually now launching into a fertility action network. If you don't follow them, they're amazing. It's going to become something that we're pushing through Parliament to try and get this, to get fairer access is the first thing. The postcode lottery needs to go, because it's just cripplingly unfair. Educating GPs, because they actually can't, a lot of them can't even read a semen analysis to know what to do with these patients that are sat in front of them, and then send people away that need actually more investigations. So there is a lot of work to be done. And actually one of the things long term, and it is very much a long term plan because we've got a lot to sort out first, is that we try and do exactly this and allow the NHS to understand family building. So watch this space, because it's going to be a very interesting couple of years if we get where we want to go.
And you guys are doing such amazing work pushing all that forwards as well. And just a bit more fairness.
The MPs are on board, right? They are really on board. And I think the removal of NHS England actually will only be helpful to us as we push forward.
Amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah.
A couple of questions around... there are just so many. It's so hard to choose. Okay, I know this might be a short one because I know what you're going to say, but we got questions around transferring multiple embryos.
Oh, that's everyone. Emma, that is everyone's dream. I know.
Twins! I know what she's going to say. Give it to us, Emma.
I would, in an ideal world, if I could send you all away with healthy twins, that the only complication is they're born at 38 weeks and you had to have a cesarean, which, by the way, is major abdominal surgery. Just, I guess, putting it out there. I would do it, but it is not that simple. It is, we have no idea, just from looking at a patient, what their capabilities are of carrying multiple embryos or multiple babies. We are Homo sapiens. We stand on our back legs. We are not on our all fours like a lot of animals are, which means our pelvises are smaller, which means we are just not equipped to carry multiple pregnancies as well as the other mammals in this world. So if you put it into basic science, the safest thing for us to do is have one baby at a time in our pelvis and sitting in our bodies as females that have evolved in the way we have. I cannot tell you the complications that I have seen with multiple pregnancies. Okay. They are tenfold increased. It is a very basic thing for me that if I think that the only reason I would do a multiple transfer is if I honestly thought I was hedging my bets and we would be lucky to get, you know, one to work. If we're dealing with sort of unscreened embryos, so those that haven't been genetically tested in women over 40, then yes, obviously I'm never not up for having this conversation, but it it has to be very, very real and very honest and come from a point of medicine and not desperation, because twins are hard and they unfortunately can be very complicated pregnancies. And what I would also say is that you can put two back and end up with three. And that has happened to me on many occasions where one of them splits and you end up with an identical twin and a third. And then, you know, these are really, really, really challenging pregnancies.
Okay.
One in, one out policy for the most part.
Okay.
Like, makes me think of like a nightclub.
Add-ons.
Add-ons. So with the genetic testing, with embryo glue, that comes up a lot. Shall we, we've spoken about time lapse. Maybe it's easiest to speak about embryo glue and genetic testing.
I think before, if you go into embryo glue and genetic testing, is I'd like to say that time lapse, if you look at the way they have been ranked on the HFEA website, it's all given as in a one pragmatic topic of conversation. So time-lapse is, time-lapse incubators will not give you any more embryos. And that is what the basis is, right? By the way, that's fact. But is that the only benefit? And my point is, who gets to decide what that benefit is for you and what your needs are as a patient? So no, time-lapse won't give you any more embryos because it's an incubator. Incubators are great. But what about what you learn from those incubators that allow you to change things in your next cycle that does give you more embryos? I'm just saying it's a one, it's not a one, a one point approach. Embryo glue is a little bit different because it is very black and white. So the studies out there suggest that embryo glue.
Because I picture a Pritt stick.
It's not Pritt stick, is it? PVC glue.
PVA.
PVA. What's PVC?
I'd love to meet the person that came up with the name because it's really clever.
It's good marketing, isn't it? I'm like, I want some of that.
Because people think that embryos have to stick. They don't. The embryo sits in your lining. I think everyone thinks that when you put an embryo back, it's like this great big cavernous hole. It's not. The lining's actually like a web. So when you pop the embryo in, it's almost like a conversation happens. And actually what happens is the embryo grows and implants. But actually what happens is the lining engulfs it. And it engulfs it into the bloodstream. Embryo glue, the idea behind it is it's really heavy on hyaluronic acid, and that is meant to send signals to the lining to help this engulfing implantation happen. So it doesn't stick, it's not literally a glue, but it is actually quite thick. So there's two things in my head, is that it can probably protect the embryo a little bit when it goes back because it's very, very thick media. So it's literally the transfer media that we would put an embryo in to load into the catheter that goes back into you when the doctor puts the embryo in, okay? There's been loads of trials done on embryo glue. It is 100% not harmful. I can safely say that it is not in any way detrimental. It's a really nice medium. It is also cripplingly expensive to buy. There has been some interesting studies on recurrent miscarriage patients where it's been seen as being helpful. There's definitely been, I've just done a trial with it, and I've definitely seen a very slight uptick in my PGTA tested embryos and the like less miscarriages, but I don't know whether it was so small. I'm not sure whether that was just the time that we were in and maybe that was the patient group we had. It's incredibly challenging with embryo glue. So I think it's promising. I don't think it's a magic fix. I think that there are, I don't think it will change the fact that if the embryo is genetically abnormal, it will not implant or it will miscarry. Embryo glue isn't going to change that. That's the point. PGTA. Now, PGTA, yeah. I'm a genetics embryologist, so I think it's about the best thing that's ever happened. It should
and
be
that,
used
sorry, Emma, just for anyone that doesn't know, that is genetic testing of embryos to see the actual genetics inside of them.
So as we age, let's play out a scenario that our woman is, our lovely patient is 40 years old and she's lucky enough to have 5 blastocysts at the end of her cycle that she's got that she can utilise, which means freeze, transfer, try and make pregnancies. Now, the law of averages and stats, I know, means that only one or two of those embryos are going to be genetically viable. So the question is, why are we putting her through 5 financially expensive, emotionally charged transfers when 3 of them aren't going to work? And what actually happens is sometimes a patient only has, say, 3, and if they're all abnormal, she could waste a whole year of reproductive aging by putting them back and having negative tests or miscarriages with those embryos that we could have defined as being normal or abnormal. Now, when you start looking at the, again, this comes to the what do you call it, the HFEA thing, it says that you will not get any more babies from from PGTA. No, you won't. I'm not saying you will. I'm not saying that you're going to make the embryos better. But you won't get any more babies, because I think actually that's quite misleading, because actually if you save a 40-year-old a year worth of her time, you are going to get her the potential to have a baby, whereas at 41 she may have... That, do you see what I mean? That percentage might have been really, really low.
So not black and white, is it?
I think it's really, really good for family building, like we were talking about earlier, is when patients come to you and say, I definitely want to have the option of having two children, but I'm 39. We could say, right, you've got five embryos in the freezer, that's going to be enough. But is it? I don't know, because they're not genetically normal. You haven't, and you walk away with this false sense of security. So I think, again, my tagline, I think I should have badges made up saying context is key. Your context is your context. And so, PGTA has apparently no benefit on whose measure? Because a woman that is wanting to build her family and know that she's got four euploid normal embryos in the freezer, I think she'll find that beneficial.
Is it as well an age thing? Because I mean, this is just me. I'm 34 tomorrow, guys. Whoop, whoop. But I was told, I asked at the follow-up appointment, should we be considering paying for PGTA? It's not on the NHS. And I was told no. And is that an age thing? Is that at this stage, it's just inverted commas, been one fail. I was 33. Everything should be...
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, and your context, Catherine. But your context, Catherine, as well, is we know you've got male factor infertility and you're not sat in front of us with three miscarriages. I think it becomes very different when you're sat in front of a patient that's 30 years old with three or four miscarriages under their belt, because actually the most common cause of miscarriage is genetics. So why are we not testing those embryos to stop her having any more miscarriages? That's context.
Right. So
for me, I only use it in women under 35, because most of the time if you look at statistics again, like we did with our 40-year-old, actually 8 out of 9 embryos in a woman that's 33 should be genetically viable. So the argument is, why are we adding it on? I agree, but not if that patient sat with four miscarriages in front of them. I think her context would tell you that she needs more answers than just putting an embryo back and having another miscarriage. So you've got to have an open dialect. You cannot have patient A and patient B and patient C all in the same circumstances. Yeah. They never
again,
are.
Yeah, it's the whole picture, isn't it? I think there's two more things that might wrap us up quite nicely.
Yeah, yeah.
Firstly, ICSI is a big topic. Obviously, we need ICSI. We don't have a choice. But ICSI versus normal IVF. I know it's newer. There were some concerns in our inbox that ICSI reduces chances, reduces success rates. Are all these myths? I hope so.
I love ICSI. I think it's the best thing that's ever happened to us, yeah.
Wow.
So ICSI is just amazing. It's just amazing. It's so ICSI in 2012, there was a paper that came out that said about congenital defects when patients were having ICSI, but actually the patients using ICSI back in the early noughties and sort of up to about 2010 were those with really severe male factor. I'm talking like cripplingly poor sperm. And then you have to question the patients that are using the ICSI rather than the ICSI process itself. Because if you've got undiagnosed reasons for like three sperm being seen, then is there something else going on that is the causative factor of that that is then leading to the problems? I don't think it's the ICSI is my point. And I think if you looked at that again now, the fact that we use ICSI quite freely now, we use it... I use it fairly routinely. I don't think you would see that. I think you would see the same as any natural conception or IVF. I've never heard anyone say to me it reduces success rates. If anything, when we talk about failed fertilization, the most times that I see completely failed fertilization, when it's a complete shock, is in couples with loads of eggs that haven't been able to conceive for 2 years, and then you do IVF, and then you find out the reason they haven't been able to conceive for 2 years is because the eggs and sperm aren't communicating. And this is where my big statement of no one's first cycle of IVF should be used as a diagnostic tool. So if someone sits in front of me that's been actively trying to conceive and they've been doing everything right and we've got no reason to why they're not conceiving and they've been at it for 2 years, I'll be doing ICSI. Because I don't need to find out why. I'd rather just make sure that I'm creating embryos that you can then utilise and not have that 5% of failed fert risk in IVF patients, which we get. So for me, ICSI is for the win, to be honest. I think it's I just wish it wasn't as expensive, because it's a brilliant tool. Yeah.
Emma, I love to hear that as an ICSI stan. Like, yeah, it's because brilliant. For some people like us, it's our, it hopefully we were like, it's what we need to do.
Yeah.
And then I think probably the last thing that might wrap us up quite nicely is the future of IVF and reproductive assisted reproductive technology. Mm. It's a big question, but kind of what do you hope for? Where do you see it going?
I'd really like us to have some more clarity around male factor diagnosis. I think that if we can start to understand the male side of things, I think we're 20 years behind in male infertility diagnosis, or even knowing what it looks like, because one sperm count does not tell you that a man doesn't have a fertility issue. 100%, it doesn't. It can't. So I think that is hopefully where we are heading, that there'll be more urologists involved and more really like reproductive specialists for men like there are for women. And I think that will help us create better embryos once we have clearer understanding of what male infertility looks like and how we can hopefully change a little bit of it, or what we need to do to assist it. I think AI will become a big player in day-to-day embryology. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think that the AI that is there at the moment, I think it's certainly good, but I don't think it's as good as the human eye just yet. I don't think it's without its challenges, but I do think that AI will definitely play a role. I don't know whether it will play a role massively in patients' embryos. I can't, maybe it will, but for me, the bit I'm really excited about is the workload and the work-life balance for the teams that look after your embryos, being able for that to be a little bit less stressful, and I think AI can be very supportive of that. And as for what comes next, I really don't know. There's talk of robots, but I don't know.
Yeah,
robots doing ICSI.
Wombs, or like people having babies outside of their wombs. Yeah, I've heard of that.
I don't think that will come around. I think we had our first baby in the UK from a transplanted womb.
Yes, we did.
We did
this week. Amazing.
So I was involved in that years ago.
Were you?
So I remember being involved. So that has been going on. That project has been going on for about 12 to 15 years.
How does it feel when breakthroughs like that happen for someone like you?
Massive, because I remember seeing patients that were born without wombs about 5, 6, 7 years ago, and we would create embryos and do PGTA on them, because the idea of having a miscarriage in a transplanted womb is obviously catastrophic. So that's where we would use genetic testing to help us avoid that. And I had patients that were on the waiting list for transplants and stuff. So to see that actually they've managed to achieve a live birth from it, oh, that's just magical. That's proper science, right?
Yeah, so, amazing. Yeah.
But yeah, watch this space. I think it'll be really interesting. I think we'll never get to 100%, and I think that is sad, but that's the truth of it. But if you think when I started doing embryology, the chance of a pregnancy was around 21%, and now I can safely say that in most women, I would say 50% of women that walk through the door will end up with a live birth from fertility treatment in the clinic I'm at. I think that's quite profound in 20 years.
Yeah.
So the future's bright, maybe. Maybe we can hope.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Emma.
Yeah, thank you.
I think we've squeezed all the juice out of that lemon. this has been so amazing and so informative, and I hope that people listening have found it informative. And Emma's such a busy lady that I'm so glad we got you for an hour or so.
And you know, your website, everyone can go to if they
yeah. So plug yourself. I've got emmatheembryologist.com, which is, I'm kind to make it like a, I try and send a newsletter every few weeks with a bit of information that comes from my brain. It's just about making an accessible platform for things like what, you know, goes on the Instagram, but Instagram's got a really tight word count. So Instagram, Emma the Embryologist on Instagram. I've actually got my own little podcast that I do with Simon, where I spout on about all the random things in my head, called Hatching a Plan. So just a bit sciencey, and I'm like an open book. So
you're brilliant. You're amazing.
Thank
and
you.
And so generous. So we're so grateful.
We are.
No worries at all.
Cool.
So yeah.
Thank you, Emma.
Thank you, Emma.
That was it.
Right, well, that was Emma, everybody.
Oh my goodness, what an ep.
What a
conversation.
Brilliant. Yeah, and thank you so much to everyone who wrote in asking questions.
It's just, you know, there's so many people looking for information, and it made us quite sad, didn't it, Sean, to kind of read everybody just desperate for help and answers, and I hope that we can help with that just a little bit. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Instagram at IVFBFFpod. You can email us.
Email at IVFBFFpod@gmail.com.
And if you like the podcast, why not give it a cheeky little rate?
Yeah.
Write a nice review if you liked it. If not, don't worry. We're fragile enough. but sending everyone big love.
Huge love wherever you are on this journey. Yep.
Yeah, speak to you soon, guys.
Bye.
Bye.